studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Caudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We're going to get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week around our region. So today, our panel includes Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com, and Ruth Brown with Idaho Reports. However, before we get started today, we do want to get an update on the fire that is burning near Stanley. Residents there have suffered through smoke and fires for the better part of this summer, and that has led to far fewer tourists over this last month, which, as so many of us know, really is the lifeblood of that business community. In fact, our James Dawson is in Stanley, and he spoke to several business owners who are facing what's looking like a scant Labor Day weekend.
Trey Cook is checking the shifting on a full suspension mountain bike that needs a little TLC after some time on the local rugged trails. His dog Lil is a few feet away, snoozing in the sun in front of his shop, Balance Bike Works, on Stanley's main drag.
The latter part of June and the first part of July, we were hopping. It was great. There was a lot of people renting bikes, a lot of people riding the pathway between here, between Stanley and Redfish.
But things changed in a hurry. The Bench Lake fire sparked next to Redfish Lake in mid-July, forcing evacuations of the nearby lodge and campgrounds for nearly 2 weeks. Now, parts of Stanley have been evacuated due to the Wapiti fire that scorched nearly 100,000 acres. Cook was one of the first to leave his home, staying with friends in Lower Stanley at first. But he's now on his third couch after that area evacuated earlier this week.
I didn't get too comfortable in the new place that I'm in. Let's put it that way. It's, you know, I've gotten pretty good at this.
His shop is still open, though he's moved his fleet of rental bikes to a new spot further south of town in case the fire does reach Stanley. Over the past couple days, the smoke comes and goes depending on the wind direction. Despite the monster lurking west of town, Cook says his spirits are high.
Even though this is a dramatic and frightening time, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. Watching my neighbors and my community just come together and pull off what needs to be done, I've been incredibly grateful to be part of.
As we talk, he's got a new customer looking to get a tire fixed.
Yeah, I think a lot of times that's what's going on is people come up with the goat heads in there, and I'll just make sure that you don't have
any. No, I know, but I think this got cut, or I don't know what happened.
Don Borowski is a 52-year-old man from Eagle who says he's been coming to the area for 15 years.
I look forward to this every year. This is our biggest vacation of the year, and we do it with about 20 other families from our community. So to see this going on, it's been pretty devastating.
Despite the smoke in the air, he didn't think twice about making his annual pilgrimage to what he calls God's country.
We want to see these places stay open and survive, and if we can do whatever little part in these tough times, we're going to do it.
Borowski says nearly everyone from his usual group is either at their spot along Redfish Lake or are on their way up from the Treasure Valley. He's been texting glamour shots to other friends trying to get them to spend the weekend in the high country. Across the street is the Sawtooth Baking Company, which typically has lines out the door this time of year. On Thursday, just a few people were drinking coffee and eating breakfast.
We're staying open for the community members, a lot who are displaced right now and need a place to gather and, well, feed human interaction.
The owner, Tim Cron, says he's letting friends who've evacuated nearby developments, along with some employees, stay with him for now. He says it's a tough time for everyone.
I would say all of the businesses do the lion's share of their business in June, July, and August. You know, when we're hit that hard with fires, it affects all the small businesses.
Just south of town, Redfish Lake Lodge is still recovering from last month's evacuations. Several families are lounging by the marina in chairs, on the dock, or in boats, but not as many as usual. As I wait to talk to one of the lodge's co-owners, Jeff Clegg, a potential guest is asking the front desk clerk over the phone about the weather conditions. When I catch up with Clegg, he says that happens a lot.
Most people have been wonderful about that, and actually our bookings are quite good. I mean, we had like 6 rooms open last night, which is, you know, very unusual for us to have rooms open, but still, you know, it's better than nothing.
Clegg says the evacuations have tipped his balance sheet into the red.
If this thing could get past us in the next week or so and we could have a strong September, then maybe we somehow break even. But you know, you know, it hurts. It's just hurting everybody, and it's just the way it is. You got to make it through.
Friends raised nearly $100,000 on GoFundMe after the evacuations so he could keep paying his 100-plus staffers, which he's thankful for. Something that's hit home for Clegg these last few weeks is just how symbiotic the relationship is between the town and the lodge, separated by only 6 miles.
They need Redfish in terms of business, and we're feeling now how much we need town. And I guess the bottom line is we truly in this small community really all need each other.
James Dawson, Boise State Public Radio News.
And we are lucky enough to have Jimmy joining us now. Jimmy, we should note you are in Ketchum today, so thank you so much for talking to us about everything that's going on in that area.
Yeah, of course, Jim. I'm happy to be here.
So I do want our listeners to know, Jimmy and I are taping this actually at 10 a.m. on Friday morning. So even though this is airing at noon, and of course, we re-air at 8 p.m., there could be some updates to this. So with that said, Jimmy, as of this morning, what do we know about the fire right now?
Yeah, I would say after watching this for the past, I mean, since it started, but certainly over the past several days as I've been closer, based on the fire commander's information, it looks like the size has been growing more slowly over the past couple days, which is a good sign. It's at about 92,000 acres right now. Still 0% contained, though, so that's something significant to watch. As for the weather, you know, when I was up here and in Stanley a few times over the past few days, it would kind of range from an apocalyptic orange color with, you know, just terrible smoke quality to kind of bluebird conditions with very little smoke. It just really depends on how the winds are actually blowing. But crews are kind of expecting a lack of strong winds, which is good for the growth of the fire. But that does mean that smoke is going to likely remain very unhealthy for the whole Stanley and Central Idaho area.
So, Jimmy, what if firefighters, what are they expecting over the next few days? As you said, a lack of wind. So does that also mean that's good for firefighting, I would assume?
Yeah, that's what they're saying. But, you know, there are several factors. You know, wind is just one of them. There's going to continue to be low humidity in the air, which means things are going to be really dry. And when things are really dry, that means that they're more likely to burn if they come into contact with embers or you know, the flames keep growing and eating all of this down timber that's kind of in the area. So, they are, again, expecting, like I said, low winds, which is good, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the fire will not grow over the weekend.
Yeah. Jimmy, what's the mood like up there? I mean, Stanley is such a special place, but it's also such a tiny community. And I'm just curious about, you know, just what it feels like to have spent time up there with these folks.
Yeah, I mean, people are pretty resilient up there. Obviously, when you're in mountainous areas, they're kind of used to fires being nearby. Not this close, but certainly more nearby. So they're used to smoke coming in and kind of disrupting tourist season. But, you know, I spoke with, as you heard in the feature, you know, Trey Cook, who runs this bike shop, say that he's had to move 3 times. You know, he was in the first evacuation zone, then he stayed with friends in the second evacuation zone. You know, so it's just kind of a lot of whiplash right now. Their spirits are high. They're still hoping that tourists will come up this weekend and help them at least recover what they can and salvage what they can of the you know, business season. But it's certainly a tough time for everyone up there.
And speaking of those evacuations, Jimmy, what are the recommendations right now for folks? Is it to stay or to maybe, you know, get out of the area right now?
So at the latest update that we have, residents can return to Lower Stanley and the Gateway community. That was as of 8 p.m. last night. They are in the ready status. or sorry, the set status, which is the level two status. So, you know, firefighters are saying, look, you can go back to your house, just be ready, because we can't guarantee that you won't be evacuated again. And then the casino zone, which is the satellite area kind of northeast of town, is being downgraded to ready status, which is the level one status. So that's good news. As far as tourists go, in their releases, fire crews have said, you know, they haven't had any restrictions. They don't say like, hey, maybe you should, you know, think twice about coming up here. They don't say any of that. Basically, just be cautious of any fire crews that might be traveling between the camp, which is like 15 miles south of town, to the fires, and just heed all the warnings. Have your headlights on, especially when the smoke is settled and visibility is pretty low.
Well, and as we said, we are taping this again at 10 a.m. So that's what the status is for ready set right now. So we will try to do our best to keep everybody updated on that. But Jimmy, we so appreciate you, you know, covering this, of course, but taking time. I know how busy you are covering all of these fires. So really appreciate you taking time.
Yeah, of course, Gemma. Thank you.
So Clark, as I mentioned in our last segment, Jimmy and I taped that about 10 a.m. this morning. So I was hoping that we could jump in with you because I know you've been covering quite a few of the fires in Idaho. And any updates for that fire near Stanley as of 12:20 this Friday? Because we have to tell folks, Clark, I mean, this kind of information moves pretty quickly.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. Absolutely. That was a great report from Jimmy, and the numbers that that he talked about on that last segment from earlier this morning, those are the same numbers that I'm seeing when it comes to the Wapiti fire that's burning near Stanley, near Idaho Highway 21 and the Boise and Sawtooth National Forest. It's interesting, Jimmy, that fire started by lightning over a month ago on July 24th. As Jimmy said, it's grown to over 92,000 acres. It did slow down a little bit in the past couple of days, like Jimmy said, but there was a lot of growth earlier in the week. For example, on Tuesday, the fire was at 70,000 acres, and this morning it's at 92,000 acres. And so it did slow down a little bit with lower winds and a little bit of an inversion, some of the things that Jimmy talked about. But there's more. There's almost 1,200 firefighters working on that fire alone. And like Jimmy said, containment is at 0%. I met with Governor Brad Little on Wednesday morning, and he told me that the Wapiti fire in Stanley is the highest priority fire in the country right now. He said that he's receiving updates multiple times a day about that fire and about all the large active fires in Idaho, particularly the ones that are burning near where people live or where people have residence or where people may be recreating. But he called it the highest priority fire in the nation. And so I know that there continues to be a lot of concern, and it's a good reminder, but you talked about how closures and evacuation orders, all that stuff can change very rapidly when we talk about a situation like this. I know for the folks in and around Stanley and Upper Stanley, it's changed quickly, and you can go through those evacuation orders very, very quickly. I did another article earlier this week kind of talking about what the evacuation orders mean, and you got into Ready, Set, Go, and that's really the system that we use in Idaho. I talked with a public information officer who's working on the Boulder fire out near Cascade, which I visited last week, and she talked about how Ready is really the notification of an emergency, and once you get that Ready notification, you want to start preparing to go. You want to make sure there's gas in your vehicle. You want to start vigorously monitoring emergency alerts, monitoring the news, because it could very quickly change from ready to set. And set is pre-evacuation, and set is what parts of Stanley are in right now. And when I talked with Carrie Green, the public information officer on the Boulder fire, she said that set is pre-evacuation, but it means be ready to go at a moment's notice. Once you hear the set notification, you should load a 72-hour survival kit into your vehicle. You should wear sturdy shoes. You should wear clothing that could protect you from heat and flames, like long sleeves, long pants. Any photos that you see of wildland firefighters, they're wearing helmets and gloves, long sleeve pants, long sleeve shirts that are made of fire resistant materials. And then finally, the third tier is go. And that's immediate evacuation. And she told me when you get go, at that point, it's time to leave immediately. I know there's anxiety and uncertainty and maybe this mentality that you want to stay and fight for your property. But she said you're endangering yourself, and you could be endangering the emergency response. And if you don't leave it go, there's no guarantee that someone could help you. I did get one other tip from Carrie to pass along for folks that are facing evacuation. And this was new to me, but she said, leave your lights on in your house and outside of your house when you go to evacuate. And Jimma, the reason that you do that is so that the firefighters can see your property through the smoke. And so that was a tip that I heard. So that was great information on the Wapiti Fire, which is by Stanley, by Grangine, in that Highway 21 corridor. And if you want, I can talk a little bit about some of the other fires over off the Highway 55 corridor over by Cascade. I had the chance to actually visited the fire line of the Boulder Fire on Thursday of last week. And Jimma, there are about 250 active duty U.S. Army soldiers that have come over from Washington State, Joint Base Lewis-McChord. And they're actually helping out with the wildland firefighters who have been on site working on that Boulder Fire, as well as some of the other fires out in your Cascade, such as the Snag Fire, the Dollar Fire, and the Goat Fire. So I went out last Thursday and I met several of the firefighters and I from the U.S. Army. I watched them work. We went right to the fire line. And what they were doing at that time was walking a grid around the perimeter of the fire. They were checking for hot spots, kind of a vigorous effort to go through after some of the main fire lines had been cleared to make sure that there wasn't heat, that there wasn't smoldering. And those crews had actually found close to 10 hot spots or spot fires that had flared up and gotten those under control. But yeah, there's about 250 U.S. Army soldiers out fighting those fires near Cascade, and they expect their deployment to last about a month. I think this is the end of the second week that they've been here, and the folks that I talked to out on the fire line are expecting to be there for about a month. And when I visited them, at least for the soldiers that I was that I met and that I talked to, they were very excited to be there. Some of them, it was their first time ever fighting a wildfire. They're actually from the 14th Brigade Engineering Battalion. And this was their first time for many of them fighting wildfires. But they said it was a critically important mission. They were excited about the chance to help the existing wildland firefighters from the federal agencies that had been out there. And they talked about this really fit in was a good mission set for them because they're able to help preserve property and perhaps save people's lives. And so that was that was the first time that I've been to a fire line in a number of years. And that was just a really interesting story. But yeah, for the last, like Jimmy and like so many other reporters, the last several weeks really been keeping an eye on all these fires and certainly on all this smoke that we're seeing all throughout central Idaho and the Treasure Valley there, Jimma.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, we appreciate all of the reporting you've all been doing on this, Clark. So, Caitlin, I want to turn over to East Idaho right now because there's an update in the Chad Daybell case. You're reporting that the judge in this case found extraordinary circumstances. So what does this mean?
Right. So just for, you know, anybody who hasn't been following along, basically, Chad Daybell was sentenced to the death penalty in June after his 8-week trial and after he was found guilty of murdering his first wife, Tammy Daybell, and his new wife, Lori Vallow Daybell's two children, Joshua Vallow and Tylee Ryan. He's starting to go through the appellate process. And on Wednesday morning, Judge Boyce heard arguments from Ian Thompson, one of Daybell's appellate public defenders, and Unfortunately, the judge did deny a request to allow video or still photographers in the courtroom, but we did have a reporter in the courtroom who told us that Daybell did show up via Zoom from the Idaho Maximum Security Institution, where his attorney basically just listed a bunch of reasons why they need more time to effectively file for post-conviction relief. So they want to ask the court to vacate or modify his sentence from the death penalty. So they did have a pretty strong point where they said that, you know, a motion for post-conviction relief has to be filed within 42 days of someone receiving their sentence. So that 42 days would be wrapped up on October 15th. And basically, his appellate lawyers have a really large amount of evidence that the team has to go through, which is 16,800 pages of trial transcripts. And then they also have to go through 12,700 gigabytes of other information. So that equates out to about 18,000 CDs. The same office that's working with Daybell on his appeals is also handling seven other death penalty cases. So Thompson argued that they are very, very busy and that they just basically need more time to argue that his sentence should be changed. So the Fremont County prosecuting attorney, Lindsay Blake, just kind of acknowledged this. She said, you know, there is a lot of evidence she has to go through, but she did clarify that she doesn't think that they need any longer than absolutely necessary. And then Judge Boyce kind of agreed. He said the case does have extraordinary circumstances, meaning the large amount of evidence in the case, that effectively make it impossible for the post-conviction relief petition to be fully completed by October 15th. So I believe that the Idaho Supreme Court actually has to approve Boyce's ruling before any kind of appellate proceedings can be continued. But assuming that happens, Judge Boyce will then schedule a conference to keep the case moving forward, and we will keep reporting on it and keeping up on it.
Okay, well, I appreciate that update. Ruth, there's also an update in the Thomas Creech case. Now, Thomas Creech was set to be executed, and can you maybe start with that? Because this was a botched execution, and now there's an update on the next steps in this case.
Thanks, Gemma. Yeah, Tom Creech was set to be executed in February, and the medical team failed to establish an IV line in Creech. They attempted his hands, arms, legs, feet, and they attempted to insert the IV, but it wasn't a connection that they were confident in, and so the execution was called off. On Thursday, District Judge Jason Scott heard arguments that there should be an evidentiary hearing in Tom Creech's case, and that revolves around Mr. Creech arguing that after the failed execution, any new attempted execution would amount to psychological torture, which would violate his Eighth Amendment right to protection from cruel and unusual punishment. Judge Scott did not make a decision. He'll issue a written decision at a later date, and I can walk you through a little bit of the state's arguments if you like.
Yeah, I would like that, Ruth, if you could.
Sure. So while the defense attorneys would argue that this is a violation of the Eighth Amendment rights, state's attorneys argue that the legislature could adopt other methods of executions and that they are wrongfully assuming that if they were to attempt an execution on Mr. Creech again, that they would do it in the same method. Some of the responses, the written responses, that is, in the case were interesting because they noted things that we don't currently have in Idaho, such as proposing that the legislature could adopt other executions, execution methods, such as the use of nitrogen hypoxia or the use of the firing squad. Now, the firing squad is legal in Idaho, but the state has not yet built a facility to use the firing squad. It's my understanding that the Idaho Department of Corrections is actually having trouble finding a contractor who will agree to build a death chamber. So currently the only active method of execution would be lethal injection. And so, you know, I mean, I think the state maintains that this is not cruel and unusual punishment, that they did attempt to offer Mr. Creech, I guess things that would make it less painful. For example, Mr. Creech was offered a sedative as well as a numbing agent at the sites where the medical team attempted to insert the IV. Now, one could go back and forth on what is and isn't cruelty. Mm-hmm. That's not my job. But I know for now, the only legal tangible method is an execution by lethal injection. Now, the Idaho Department of Correction could change that, but they haven't as of August 30th.
Right. So at this point, Ruth, we are just waiting now to see what the decision the judge makes after having had this hearing.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So Ian, Attorney General Raul Labrador is in some hot water with the Idaho Bar Association over some allegations of misconduct. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah. So the Idaho State Bar has opened an investigation into Labrador over allegations of misconduct, as you said, that stem from a complaint filed by a former state official. And the Idaho State Bar is a self-governing state agency that's responsible for overseeing and administering what are known as the professional rules of conduct for attorneys. Those are essentially ethics guidelines that any lawyer in the state is required to abide by. And Dave Jepson, the former director of the Department of Health and Welfare, who retired late last year, filed this complaint last year, essentially alleging that Labrador had failed to properly represent his agency and officials in his agency when he was pursuing investigations into the health department. And last month, the State Bar sent a letter to Attorney General Labrador asking him to respond to specific allegations and specific specific potential rule violations that they are investigating at the moment. And so we'll see in the coming weeks or months what happens with the investigation if it's made public. I should note that these are generally, investigations by the Idaho State Bar are confidential and not released to the public. But in this case, Mr. Jepson released the complaint that he had filed to my newspaper, the Idaho Statesman. And so we've been able to report on the status of this investigation.
So, Ian, I understand that Jepson did not give any more comment after he released that that complaint. But you did get a comment from the Attorney General's office, did you not?
Yes, absolutely. The Attorney General's office denies the allegations in the complaint, says that they're baseless and meritless and a political hit. And I think kind of the what's interesting about this investigation in this case is that Labrador, since he's taken office as Attorney General around a year and a half ago, has taken us often in a number of cases, taken confrontational stances, you might say, with other state agencies and instances where he's suspected potential wrongdoing or even potentially a violation of law in instances with the State Board of Education or the Department of Health and Welfare. And in those cases, this Attorney General is tasked by law with representing state agencies, but he's also tasked with enforcing certain laws. And so that kind of puts him in a delicate position and in a position where he needs to navigate how to both represent those agencies or provide adequate legal representation for those agencies while also pursuing what he sees as a necessary and needed investigation into potential issues at that agency. And Jepson, as well as a few other officials, have felt over the past year and a half like the Attorney General has not handled those properly. And so I think that's kind of what this investigation gets down to and kind of what it specifically is about.
Well, and we should note that the Idaho Bar Association doesn't do investigations all of the time, right? I mean, they get complaints all of the time. So to take this up and do an investigation, you know, doesn't mean that they're going to find wrongdoing, but it does mean that there is enough information in the complaint that they do want to investigate this further. Is that a fair assessment, Ian?
Yes, it definitely does not mean that they will find wrongdoing. They have not, as of now, accused the Attorney General of any particular violations. Rather, they're involved in an investigation to look into this case and gather more information. But what they do say is that, as you mentioned, they receive a number of grievances about attorneys in the state. And it's in cases where they feel like the allegations that are made, if they're true, might warrant potential violations of the code of conduct. And so that's mm-hmm. then what they engage in investigating, is determining whether those allegations are indeed true or whether they're not true.
And then if there is something, if they determine that there is something true, then sanctions can be imposed. But that ranges the gamut.
Yes, that's also an important part of this, and a part of the way that they operate. They have a number of sanctions that they can impose on lawyers, ranging from private discipline, essentially a letter to an attorney notifying them that they violated a rule of conduct, but that's not released publicly, to more severe sanctions like public notices or more seriously, a suspension of an attorney's license, or even kind of the maximum penalty could be disbarring an attorney. But those decisions, once the state bar is finished with their investigations, get referred to the Idaho Supreme Court to make a final determination for those more serious sanctions against an attorney.
All right. Well, appreciate the update on that. But again, at this point, just an investigation. So want to make that clear for our listeners. Ruth, a judge is granting a hearing, speaking of the Attorney General's office, in the Attorney General's fight against a ballot initiative. So before we begin on the latest and what happened with this hearing, can you quickly just update folks on the case itself?
Yeah, sure. So the complaint with Ada County was filed after the original complaint, which went to the Idaho Supreme Court. The Attorney General Raul Labrador is trying to stop the Open Primaries Initiative from making it on the November ballot. The Idaho Supreme Court declined to hear the case, so they never even got to the oral arguments stage. And that was mostly for procedural reasons. In that opinion, the Idaho Supreme Court did say, if you have accusations of fraud, whether that is, I guess, fraudulent signatures on the petition, it needs to go to the district court. So they did that. They went to the district court, and on Thursday they had a hearing before Judge Miller.
Okay. And so Judge Miller is now granting this hearing. But we're kind of coming up against a pretty significant timeline, Ruth, because these ballots do have to get printed. So when will this hearing take place?
Sure. So the judge did use his discretion to expedite it, and the hearing will be at 10 a.m. on Wednesday at the Ada County Courthouse. And I believe the attorneys need to have their legal arguments in by noon. It's important to note that the Idahoans for Open Primaries attorney does fully intend to file a motion to dismiss. They do not support Raul Labrador's efforts, nor do they, buy into his accusations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but at this point now, we know there's a hearing come Wednesday, so we will wait to find out the very latest on that. Caitlin, I was very interested when I was reading this. There is a literal black market hunting tag scheme. Not only is there one, but this was uncovered. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, it's a pretty crazy, long, drawn out, complicated story. but I'll try and kind of condense it. So,
okay.
In Twin Falls, there is a group of men who have been charged for allegedly harassing wildlife with a helicopter, illegally selling hunting tags and a bunch of stuff, guiding without a license, hunting to spot or communicate the location of wildlife from aircrafts, like a bunch of felonies I've never heard of, a bunch of misdemeanors and fish and game violations. But essentially, the police reports tell us that a man named Carl Studer, who owns Three String Cattle Company Ranch and is the president of Electric at Quantra, he's a co-founder of Probst Electric in Utah. He was one of the people that was charged. And then Kevin Seelaff is a pilot with Alpine Aviation, and he was also charged. So essentially, these two people would go up in a helicopter, and according to the court documents, they would scout for wildlife with the helicopter and basically chase big game animals with them, which is super illegal. The pilot was apparently paid $133,000 by Carl Studer to fly him and some of his coworkers around so they could shoot coyotes. And then there was also a part of this case that was kind of uncovered that I don't know if a lot of people knew about, where they were illegally selling landowner appreciation program tags to and from men, where they paid at least $153,000 to multiple people for these hunting tags for deer, pronghorns, moose, elk, black bears, mountain lions, black bears, again, two gray wolves, and elk. So these are non-transferable. They're very illegal to sell. You can get them through a lottery-based system legally, but after you are awarded one, you cannot sell it. And they the officers found a bunch of text messages between, I think, about five different men that are selling these tags. One of the tags was sold for like $15,000. And it's a pretty crazy situation. They were paying each other under the table for things like going out and scouting for wildlife while someone else was working. So they knew where the best place was to find animals. They would fly the helicopter around, and people started getting kind of suspicious around the Twin Falls area because they would see a red helicopter flying around, shooting animals. And so there were multiple reports of this happening. And eventually, I believe in July, they started to actually charge these people with crimes. There was even an instance where one of the defendants illegally possessed a live pronghorn buck after it was shot. And there is apparently a video of a pronghorn gasping in the back of a brown Toyota truck. And it's very illegal to possess a live pronghorn buck and just keep it alive like that. And so they did appear in court in Twin Falls County last week, and they are facing a pretty lengthy prison sentence if they are convicted. So I think it's about 15 years. And we don't usually report on Twin Falls, but it's a little bit out of our coverage area. But this one is really important and interesting. So we're going to keep looking at it.
Yeah, I agree. It was, if folks want to read more, go to eastidahonews.com, because this is something that, I mean, we have a lot of hunters in our state, and people follow the rules and they follow the laws. You know, the majority of hunters do. And you know, you just don't want bad actors. With that said, they have only been charged. They have not been, you know, they are presumed innocent, you know, unless something happens in court. But appreciate all of that reporting, Caitlin. Clark, there could be a decision coming soon over the proposed Lava Ridge Wind Project outside of Twin Falls. Can you quickly tell us what the issue is and then when we might see a decision in this?
Yeah, for sure, Gemma. Basically, there's a company called Magic Valley Energy that is seeking to build a wind farm called the Lava Ridge Wind Project on public lands, on BLM land in southern Idaho near Dietrich, kind of outside of Twin Falls. Originally, it called for up to 400 wind turbines. The latest alternative plan shrinks that proposal down to 241 turbines. And I actually caught a meeting at the Idaho State Capitol building last week where the legislature's Committee on Federalism had a bunch of people out to kind of speak in opposition to the wind farm project. And some county commissioners there said that basically the BLM could be issuing a final record of decision at any time. And actually, at that point, Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador promised that he would appeal any kind of a decision to approve the Lava Ridge Wind Project. I know that's been covered extensively, and there is a lot of discussion about that, but standing by at this point for a final decision at any point, really there, Gemma.
Okay, so it could come at any time, Clark, to see what happens on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And the meeting at the State Capitol building, they invited a bunch of people that were opposed to the project and didn't invite anybody in favor of the project. And they kind of painted it as everybody is against it. And so I called up some conservationists I know at the Idaho Conservation League. They said they've actually come out in support of the latest project because it reduces the impact on wildlife and on cultural sites and on airplanes for agricultural purposes. And what they told me is that if we don't get serious about stopping pollution and supporting some of these clean energy projects, then we're going to be faced with the most serious consequences of climate change and looking at extinction of species. And so it was a little bit of a one-sided hearing last week at the State Capitol building, but the latest news is that kind of folks on all sides are standing by for a final decision at any point. I know Ian's also covered that extensively and is keeping track of it as well there.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ian, some possible good news for homeowners as folks could see even more property tax relief than originally expected?
So, yeah, so lawmakers last year passed a law to try to provide tax relief for property owners in the state. And it's a pretty complicated bill. It does a number of things. For instance, it redirects some other state funds, some other state income towards education funding to try to reduce the pressure on using property taxes for that purpose. And a part of the bill, in particular, though, it also directs surpluses in state budgets be redirected back to taxpayers as property tax relief. And so a surplus is when the state budgets and forecasts that they will spend a particular amount of money and will raise a particular amount of money, you know, based on sales tax and other income that the state gets, but then they actually earn more money and take in more money than they expect to. That's what a surplus is in the state budget. And in this case, because Idaho's fiscal years end in the middle of the summer, rather than they're different from the regular calendar year, the state had more than $52 million surplus in this past fiscal year that just ended on June 30th. And there's also the governor's office has said another $24 million in unspent funds that were appropriated to state agencies that they're also planning to use for this property tax relief fund. So overall, that's about 76 more million dollars that property owners around the state could see in property tax relief. I think what's key here, though, and what's maybe difficult to you know, comprehend is that the tax setting authority and the budgets in this state are often based locally. So cities and counties where people live, the areas that tax their property, set their own budgets each year and their various expenses, of course, that they need money for and that they often need to increase their budget for, fire department, police funding, things like that. And so it'll be very hard to know what specifically that property tax relief might look like for any individual property owner until we get later in the year, possibly into the fall. And once those estimates can be figured out by the assessor's office and when they actually send out notices to property owners for their tax bills.
All right. Well, I appreciate all of that and everyone for coming on and updating us on everything that's been happening this week. A big thank you to Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com, and Ruth Brown with Idaho Reports, along with our James Dawson, who joined us earlier in the hour. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.